Hello, 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 hello. One of the best things is when people want to come back on the podcast, they've thought about what they want to tell you, and they're really excited about it. Oh, yeah. I'm Todd Conklin, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your loving host, and I'm glad to be here. And if I didn't already kind of shoot the moon on this one, today is a great day because today is Jim Barker coming back to talk to us about some notions he has around complexity that exists in organizations. Now, Jim is from Dalhousie University. He's been on the podcast before. In fact, there was a request for a repeat, and the repeat led to the chance to do another one. And I sent him an email, and he said he'd love to, and he wanted to talk about how people know they're right, the constant quest to look for what's right. And I thought, holy crap, that would be interesting. And then by the time we actually set up the podcast to record it, he said, I've got two more things I want to talk about. So now I know at least there's more things in the podcast coming down. The great thing is that now, because he's done one and because he's listened to him and because he's heard you do one, if you've done one, it's great. You're going to love this. And you're going to love the fact that a business school chairperson in a major Canadian university, big old school, is thinking about safety and reliability. And that's pretty remarkable. Things are amazing here. It's encroaching into November. I have traveled a lot towards the end of the year, and things are going to slow down, which is always pleasant for the holidays, at least in the United States where I am. And that'll be fun as well. I'm really looking forward to what next year's theme is going to be. This year was gratitude, and I think I did it, but I didn't do it as well as I should. I think I'm going to maybe build on the gratitude idea. But you know, that's what I do, is I get a theme every year, and I try to hold that theme and experiment with it, a great sociological experiment. In the past, 1 year I spent the whole year saying yes to every request. That was actually a great year. 1 year I bought somebody lunch every possible day I could. So I bought a whole bunch of lunches, and that was really to see how that sort of happened. What happened? My advisor, Everett Rogers, the father of diffusion scholar in my PhD program, I always noticed one thing about him. He always bought somebody lunch. Every day he bought somebody lunch. And I thought, in honor of Everett Rogers and to see what this feels like, I'd try it. And I did it for a year, and it was fun. I've always thought I could write a book about it because I have a million stories. Because when you buy somebody lunch, especially someone you don't know, there's often a moment there of awkwardness and then a moment of just kind of sheer joy. And I'm not sure if it's their joy because someone bought them lunch or your joy because you got to make them that happy. But either way, it's part of what happens. I hope things are going well. I know the markets are weird, and I know that cost and prices are pressing you guys really hard and you're resource constrained. But I also know that that makes safety more important, not less important. Now, that conversation is a conversation you have to have with your managers, and they'll be ready for it. Don't hesitate. They get it. But the resources that we once had to do things have reduced, and that's a part of it as well. Other than that, life is grand here. I'm always looking for more people. Thank you for subscribing, and certainly thank you for telling people about the podcast. The more people that listen to them, the better they are, and they're just getting better and better and better. Not me. I'm not getting better. But the people we're interviewing, I've learned a lot, and this one is one of those ones where you're going to learn a lot. Jim's going to talk to you about complexity, and he's going to talk to you about conditions, but he's going to talk to you about the notion of right. And he's going to term it in a great way to think of it, the big R, sort of the moral right, and the small R, the operational right. But let's let Jim tell you about that, and then at the end of the podcast, we can come back and talk more about it. Here it is, ladies and gentlemen, Jim Barker on the Pre-Accident Podcast.
Let's do another one.
Well, that's what we're doing, baby.
So when you want to start the official podcast part, just let me know, and we'll launch.
Anytime, man. We're going already, so hit it anytime you want to start. I'm ready.
Well, the last time that we talked and worked on a podcast, Todd, one of the things that we talked about was the adage that we have that said change is constant. And when we get real frustrated and we don't understand change, we'll just throw that term out, throw up our hands, and go on. And then we unpacked that a bit in the last podcast.
Right.
We talked about well, what do we actually mean when we use that term? Well, for this one, Todd, I want to take another term that we use a lot, And there's no right answer. That's the same kind of thing. Whenever we're frustrated by something, particularly about the state of relativity in the universe, we'll throw up our hands and say, well, there's just no right answer. And notice what, you know, again, that when we use that phrase, you know, we're frustrated because we're not sure. We're not sure what's right.
Yeah, and that uncertainty is really strong for us, right?
Well, it is, and I think that we get a lot of that certainty, that uncertainty, because when we think about what is right and the right answer, we're pushed in the wrong direction. We're not given a lot of help, particularly in my area, which is in business schools. We don't get a lot of help to find that right answer. Because what's happening, Todd, we're desperate for the right answer. We're searching for the right answer. It's just not the right answer we think we want. We're taught that we should get a big R or a capital R right, that grand moral right thing to do, that we should be able to get to that space. We should know what that is. If we're not, we're something less than an ethical person. So that all the decisions we make should be in that big R right space.
Well, so let me pull the string a little bit on that, and not to try to interrupt too much, but this moral judgment thing, that's really, really powerful. I see it all the time. We apply moral judgments to workers who make mistakes. We apply moral judgments to workers who have accidents. We apply moral judgments to managers who make decisions. Is that inescapable?
Well, it's inescapable because of how we're taught. The way that we're taught about morals, we're either taught about morals on a societal and cultural level, or we're taught about morals on an individual or psychological level. And those are the realms that we think that morals exist at. But that's the capital R morals. You know, you should always be that big R, that capital R right person, and make that right decision that you can get there. But that's not what works in complex reality. The complex reality is the world, and it's so context driven. How we make sense, and make sense is the operative word here. How we make sense of complexity is context driven. It's in the present moment. It's right now. It's how you. You know, and we have to make decisions in the space that we snap our fingers. You know, that's how quickly we have to make decisions. The real world is a little r, a lowercase r right, and that's actually the right answer. We don't need the big capital R right. What's right? You know, what's this grand moral right? That doesn't help us very much when we're facing these moment by moment, day to day decisions. What we need to be able to find is what is right right now. What's that lowercase r, that little r right, that has a good probability of getting us in the capital R right space? Now, let me use the analogy here, Tom. It's one that you use quite well. And again, one of the best examples I've heard you talk about this, and the phrase that you'll say is that we do what we need to do to be productive. Productive and being productive, notice how what you said there, Tom, when you say that, you're talking about right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
do
yeah,
what
yeah.
To do to be productive right now is we are making sense of the context right now. And I know one of the best stories that you tell is the story of the poor maintenance guy working for the pharmaceutical company who's trying to get their conveyor belt going again so they can keep producing medicine. It's been hours and hours. The belt hasn't been running. They're falling way behind schedule. So finally, he tries to pick up the conveyor belt with his hands and shift it the fraction of an inch that it needs to go and cuts off part of his finger.
Right.
But all he was doing was trying to do what's right right now. He is under intense pressure to be productive, and so he was just trying to do that. And that's how we get into these kinds of safety errors. You know, this isn't far off concepts that others have talked about with drift and other kinds of things. It's the same kind of space that we're talking about. We are driven to be productive. We have to be productive. That's what organizations are about. Now, for me as an educator, there's no pedagogy about this little R right. All the pedagogy that you encounter is how to get into that big R, that big grand moral, that big ethical space. There's no pedagogy for how you solve this kind of day-to-day problem where there is no clear ethical space. You're just trying to increase the probability that you'll be in that grand ethical space. You're just trying to do what makes you productive right now. And, another thing that we talk a lot about in safety is how a 70% solution is a good one. That's what we're talking about. A little R right that's a 70% solution, that's a pretty good solution. And unfortunately, we do hit the bad side of the number sometimes But that's what happens. That's why we, you know, safety has to be at the forefront of our thinking. But we also have to think about the reality of it. And the reality of it is that there is a right answer. In any situation, we're desperate for that right answer, but it's the little r right. And that's how we have to teach ourselves to get to. That's the kind of space we have to get into, is what is right now, and being able to do that with some degree of confidence.
Well, so for me now, when you say there is a little r right answer, and I really, you're blowing my mind. I love this big R, little r. I actually really do. It makes a lot of stuff make sense to me. Do you mean there's only one right way, little r, or there is a right answer contextually?
I don't want to mean that, Todd. And I want to get away from me that, because that throws us back to the big R. You know, that's how we're conditioned to think in the big R space. There's lots of potentialities.
Gotcha.
You know that in any situation, situations are rife with potential. That's one of the lessons of complexity. But we're talking about organization. We're not talking about individual psychology. We're not talking about culture. We're not talking about society. We're talking about an organization. Different things happen in an organization. We get in an organization, we like to think we're playing by the societal rules or the cultural rules or the psychological rules. We're playing by a different set of rules. There are different kinds of potentialities. So yeah, there's multiple potentialities. What we are trying to get at, Todd, when I say we have to have the little r answer, what we're looking for is that answer that has a high probability, or the highest probability we can get, of moving us in the big R right direction. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to keep moving in a direction that puts us in that big R space, but it's only a probability. And all we can do is try to increase that probability. Well, it won't be perfect. It's not, that doesn't happen in this kind of organizational real-time world. Although we like to think it does, it doesn't.
Interesting. I like this.
Well, now here's another one, Tom. You know, let's go back to right.
Yes.
You know, again, and you tell all kinds of great examples of this, but let's go back to the poor maintenance guy again. How do you know that you're right? You never know that you're right, especially when we're in this little large space. In the moment, you don't know if you're right or not. You don't. You're trying to be productive. You're trying to make a decision. You're trying to keep things moving forward. You only know you're right when you get a consequence. It takes a consequence before you know, I made this decision. Did it move things in the right direction? You have no way to know until you have a consequence.
And I would add to that that the crazy thing about that is being wrong feels exactly like being right until you have that consequence. So you don't get data pre-consequence, really, do you?
No, you don't. You can't. It's just you don't. The data, by definition, the data is not there at the moment of decision. But back to the poor tech. He's just trying to be productive, and he's under tremendous pressure. So to try to move things in the right direction to get the assembly line belt going again, you know, he violates a safety principle. He picks it up. Well, he has a bad outcome. Right? He cuts off his finger. That's very important. But again, all he was trying to do was to keep things moving forward, or to get things moving forward again. And that's a tremendous amount of pressure. And we don't appreciate the kind of pressure that we have to be productive and how that affects these day-to-day decisions. We recognize that when we hit the 30% error, we tend not to recognize it when we're in the 70% space that we're in most of the time. Because most of the time when we're making the decisions, you know, 70%, that's a really good number. And we hit it 7 times out of 10.
Wow. That's great, actually. I mean, this is great. It's incredibly complicated, and it's sort of horrible sounding, but it's great to hear you talk about it like this.
And then the problem is, because it's such a conundrum, again, we don't teach it. And I see that as a systems scholar in business schools. You know, we don't teach students how to make these little R kinds of decisions. We don't teach students how to improve their capability or their probability of making a good little R decision. You know, we teach them all kinds of things about staying in the big R space, and we see the result of that. You know, because it's just not functional for us. Now, the thing I try to do, I try to focus a lot on practice. My belief is that as a student, the more experienced you are in dealing with the little R difficulties, And so the more experience you have in trying to deal with those kinds of decisions, and you're in a space where you can talk about them like peers, like a good safe space with peers, and a classroom can do that. The more that you can talk about these decisions and unpack all the forces that were operating here on what how people were making sense, the better you are, or the better you will be, you know, with real-time decisions, the more likely you are to make a decision that keeps you in that big R space. And so that's what I try to do in my own teaching. I don't like to use big cases. I use a lot of short scenarios. And we try to unpack what's going on here. Why are the decisions being made the way that they're doing? What forces in the context were compelling people to make sense of productivity in particular ways? And so that's what we do. And we're just trying to practice our ability in a safe space to make these kinds of difficult, real-time, spur-of-the-moment decisions. And my assumption is that I'm operating on it, that just improves your overall ability.
Why would big case studies be bad?
Too much information.
Oh, okay, good.
I'm more interested in this, you know, that I'm more interested in the decision that you, well, I'm more interested in the decision that technician makes to when he gets to the point where I have no other options other than to try to violate a safety rule and try to move the table manually, the assembly line table.
Right.
That's the decision I'm interested in.
What about simulations like pilots use when they simulate lots of little problems one at a time when they go back into their recertification?
Because you get to that real time understanding.
Okay.
You know, but yeah, I think simulations are great. Okay. I use simulations as well. I use simulations a lot to focus in on sense making. And really what I guess with the suite of simulations I use in my class right now, I use them less to talk about the decision we make. I use them more to talk about how the people, the group, or whoever's doing the simulation. I use simulations more to talk about how did you make sense of this situation when it was presented to you. What stood out? What information did you give credibility to? What did you not give credibility to? How did you try to make your response to that situation persuasive so other people would believe that you did the right thing? You know, those are the kinds of things that I like to use simulations for.
I mean, this is all amazing. I'm still, I love this division between big R and small R. I mean, it makes sense to me. It helps me understand how an operator functions in an organization that's filled with multiple dilemmas, you know, and everybody's in organizations with multiple dilemmas. What do we do as managers, business owners, system owners? What do we do in that space to create a better than 70% odds package?
Well, there are several things that we can do. The biggest thing that I believe is just the perspective that you get when you understand this, you know, when you understand what is the right answer that we're looking for. And what that right answer is what's right right now. We're desperate to have that. We have to know that. We have to be able to make good enough sense of a situation to get into that space. So where I tell, again, when I'm teaching, say, middle managers, for example, what I work with them on is how do you improve the conditions that affect sense-making? So we all know from systems, Todd, you know this well, Todd, I've heard you talk about this before, how conditions drive the system. All right. So what do you do as a manager? What do you have control over? You have control over the conditions. So you want the people to act differently, change the conditions. So that's what we work on. We work on trying to identify what kinds of conditions are present, like authority to act. You know, does someone have, you know, do your subordinates have authority to act for these kinds of situations where they can use their own expertise to act? Or when do they cross a threshold where they need your approval? Now, this is all very particularistic. By that, I mean it's unique to the context. It's unique to that particular work group. It's unique to that particular middle manager. We have to realize that as well, that there's no big benchmark here. You can't take one organization set for dealing this, overlay it onto another one. It just doesn't work that way. It's too context sensitive, too many potentialities. What you have to do as, again, for me in this particular class, focusing on middle managers, what I want them to do is what are the conditions that you have set in place? How do those conditions create, or did those conditions enable people to make sense the way that you need them to make sense? Meaning, can they make the little r decisions in the way that you need them to make? If the answer is yes, wonderful. If the answer is no, change the conditions.
How do you propose, in that case, how do you propose they, so what conditions should they look at and what are they looking for?
Well, some of the big ones, just the talked about authority to act, which is a big one. If I'm working for you, Todd, and you need me to exercise some degree of autonomy, make certain kinds of decisions, particularly to keep things moving, keep things going, well, you have to help me understand that I've got the authority to act, that you're okay. Here's a way that's commonly done. Like, Todd, you may come to me and say, all right, Jim, when you're facing any of these situations and you need to spend some money, it's okay if you spend up to $2,000. Anything over $2,000, let me buy off on it. Well, you've given me authority to act. Those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. But again, it's particularistic. So you as a manager, you've got to figure out what conditions they'll need to put in place.
But that's really helpful. I mean, that gives a nice operational parameter around there that I think we can understand. You put that in the safety arena. You're basically saying, here's the upper threshold of what you can do or spend, and here's the lower threshold of what you can do or spend. So you have ability to change the procedure within these two parameters as needed based upon particular context-dependent conditions that you're encountering when you're making, a widget. They're in the widget factory.
Right, but notice back to sense-making. Now, remember, this all hinges
right on
our ability to make sense of the context in the present moment. So, again, authority to act is important to act within that context. And so it gives, like, using the word parameters, which is a good one, it gives an understanding of the parameters that I can act within. And so, again, what I'm saying, if I act within those parameters, generally I'm in a good space. I'm in that big R kind of space because I'm making good little r decisions. And I know if I move outside that threshold, then I need something else. I need to come to you.
In a complex organization, how do operators make sense?
What we look for, there are certain ways that we make sense out of a complex context. First, we've used the words constraints and parameters, and those are really good ones. Because it ain't, again, let's think about that 70%. There are constraints and parameters that we use to keep our behaviors in that 70% range. Accounting procedures are a good one, like what you're supposed to report on your expense for your expenses. Those help us. Those are good sets of parameters and constraints that keep us behaving in the right way when we're on an expense account. So we have those, and most of the time, they're not unlike the accounting procedures. Most of the time, these things aren't written down, but we need to know what they are. So you as a manager can help people understand what the parameters and what the thresholds are. What are the constraints? What are the parameters? What are the constraints that are operating on the field that we're in right now? Time's a good constraint. How quickly we need to act. How quickly does something need to be processed? How quickly does something need to be done? How quickly does this roof need to be repaired? Those kinds of things.
Gotcha.
So facilitating that kind of awareness of the thresholds, the constraints, and the parameters that are consequent to the work that we're trying to get done. We don't really think about those, Tom. We just assume everyone knows them, and we don't ever really talk about them or go over them very much, or try to understand them for what they are, things that affect how we make sense.
I agree with you completely, and I would guess, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I would guess that's because of the power of the big R. So we tell people there is one right way to do
right.
work. There's one right way for a pharmacist to do a drug distribution, right? There's one right way. When in reality, that's not true. Because of particulars and context and complexities, the fact that systems are always running degraded, there are multiple right ways, all in the little r category, that eventually get us to the big R category. And that drives management thinking into big R, but workers live in small r. Is that fair?
Well, everyone really lives in the small R. It's just very apparent in terms of being able to understand it, to use the analogy that you just used about where the workers live.
Well, and also I would add to that that because managers deal with these questions post-consequence, after the data is present, you know, the outcome is now very apparent, that it's easier to jump into big R, right, than it is to live in the multiple small R's that had to exist in both the success and the failure. Is that fair?
But notice how once the failure occurs, how rapidly we shift back to the big R. You know, that's how we make sense of the failure. That's how we assign blame.
That's crazy, but it's so true.
But that's what we do.
Oh, you know, no, it's so true. It's
you particularly, where I learned this lesson, actually, Todd, was in the military. When I was in the military, and as a young junior officer, I was responsible for making an awful lot of decisions. And should ever one of those had been wrong, I would have been in really big trouble because I would have automatically defaulted back to the big R, and that wasn't the space I was operating in. I was just trying to get stuff done.
So we look at this. So your secret, the solution to this idea, if there's a solution, I don't know if that's the right word, a coping mechanism for this idea is to really understand the conditions around the small R decisions, right?
Right, yes. Particularly, those are the things that a manager can affect. Another thing that we know back to systems, and again, it's back to another thing that I've heard you say before, Todd. You know, it's a lot easier to fix people than it is to fix a system. Well, conditions are part of the system. So if you focus in on conditions, then you're working the system and trying to shape the system in a better way.
There's a lot to think about here. This is really good. Can people just come up and hang out with you and follow you around and kind of, you know, wear robes and sandals and sit at your feet?
Sure. Why not?
Why not? So what do you think? Wow. So here's the example that got me. I don't know where you guys are in this. About everything about that made me think. But the way we manage travel is very different than the way we manage, for instance, a field decision making around hazard identification. There is no one right way to do travel. There are many right ways that add up to the right way to do travel, but because travel is so variable and I don't know what dinner is going to cost and I don't know what the taxi is going to cost, we actually put parameters around our travel expense reporting in order to manage the big R. So the way travel is done morally, ethically, and successfully is we manage all the little decisions, the small R's, in order to get to the big decision. I don't know about you guys, but I'll bet I talk about that more because I think that's easily expandable and understandable to managers, leaders, and workers who exist in the system, in order to kind of understand and take that and move it to the way we manage work. I don't know, kick it around. It's very interesting and an amazing podcast. As always, if you've got comments or questions, get a hold of me quick. I'm easy to get a hold of. I'm at toddconklin@gmail.com. Hit me up and tell me what you need and what you want. Until then, thank you for your time today. You did a marvelous job. Can't do the podcast without you. Tell your friends. Let's get the numbers up and subscribe if you will. And your comments are always appreciated. Until then, learn something new every day. Have a lot of fun. And for goodness sakes, be safe.